Hey, this is Ari. Welcome back to the Energy Blueprint Podcast. With me today is my close personal friend, Dr. Alan Christensen, who is a board-certified naturopathic endocrinologist and the founding president of the Endocrine Association of Naturopathic Physicians and the American College of Thyroidology. He has written a number of books, but his most recent one is the Hormone Healing Cookbook. And basically, this takes you through a number of specific recipes and specific foods that are useful for dealing with some of the symptoms that emerge typically in midlife that are associated with hormonal changes, both in men and women, but I would say probably with a focus on hormonal changes in women. There's a lot of interesting insights in this book, and we talk about a lot of those insights here in this podcast. So, with no further ado, enjoy this podcast with Dr. Alan Christensen. Dr. Christensen, it's a pleasure to have you back. I think this has got to be number four, at least. Maybe number five. I don't know. We've had so many conversations on podcasts. It's hard to keep track.
Woohoo, I'll take it. Fun to have the excuse to hang out either way.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have a new book coming out, and it is the Hormone Healing Cookbook. And it's very cool stuff. And there's a lot of novel stuff in here that's not common for people to talk about. I learned a few new things, which I'm always grateful for. Wow. And awesome. I'm excited to dig into this with you. We're going to be talking all about healing hormones and how to do so with food. So maybe as broad context to get us into this discussion, talk to me about why hormone levels change in the first place as we age. So why do women go through menopause and why do men go through manopause? You know, that's a commonly sort of joked about term now, but what's going on here with these hormone changes?
It's a fascinating question. You know, one older model was that we wear out and our bodies are just tired and therefore there's less of them because we can't make them. That's not really taken seriously anymore. The body has the capacity to make hormone. There's not a lot of metabolic cost to making hormone, but there's a lot of ways in which we intentionally downregulate our energy output and our repair because we can't sustain it as well. So yeah, hormones are controlling all of that stuff. And as our bodies enter into some sort of, you know, planned obsolescence, so to speak, our genetic code starts to slow us down, the hormones are often mediators for that. So yeah, they're changing. And what happens is that it correlates with so many of the symptoms of age, you know, the loss of lean body mass, the changes in cognitive function, the decreased rates of tissue repair, less energy output. These things all pretty well track with these hormonal changes.
Explain to me planned obsolescence a little bit more in detail. I mean, obviously, in the context of technology, there's a very clear an explicitly financial incentive for makers of technology to incorporate some degree of planned obsolescence into the technology. But
your razor blades wear out after a few weeks and you buy new razor blades.
iPhones, like we want people to feel like a year or two from now, their iPhone or their Android phone or whatever is a little bit ancient and a little bit primitive compared to the latest technology and maybe is already starting to dysfunction a little bit. But how do you see that working as far as humans? What would be, obviously there's no financial incentive for our maker to create that sort of planned obsolescence, whether our maker being God or evolution or nature or however you want to see it. But what is it a resource thing? Like what would be the sort of reason for humans to become obsolete as we age?
Well, for starters, to say that there is a tidy answer to aging or that we know tidy answers to aging, we got to put a lot of asterisks and caveats on that stuff. So I'll throw that out there. In terms of incentives, and I guess another thought, there's two facets to this. There's, do we think this happens? And there's a reason why it would happen. So there's strong arguments from geneticists that a lot of aging is not just wear and tear or oxidative damage, that it's deliberate. In a lot of ways, our bodies are hardwired to quit after a little while. You know, we see limits on cell replication. Cells quit dividing at some point. And a lot of aging is that new cells cannot replace the old dead cells very readily. And it's not so much that they couldn't, it's that there's been a an expiration date, so to speak. There's been this hay flick limit. There's been this number of times in which now we're not allowed to copy any further. So it seems that it's not a matter that we couldn't go longer. It's a matter that there's some deliberate ways by which our genetic codes inhibit us from doing so.
Yeah.
So then we could the question as to, well, why would that happen? And I picked these books that this book up again, not too long ago. Rudyard Kipling wrote the Just So stories. And there's all these fun stories about, like, you know, how the elephant got his trunk. And there's a story about how the elephant, you said, this little tiny, his line was a mere smear boot of a trunk. And one day he went to ask the crocodile what the crocodile had for breakfast. And so the crocodile grabbed his stumpy trunk and pulled on it. So now the elephants have long trunks. So there's just so stories. So we can always make just so stories as to why things happen. But one argument as far as a just so story of why this happens is that at some point we could become utilizing resources. The more there are old apes around, there's too many old apes to compete with young apes for the bananas. And another just so story is that we would have a slower time frame for iteration. You know, if we had one genetic model out for a long period of time, it may not adapt as readily. You know, if the generation time frame was longer, there'd be fewer generations within a certain time window to allow for less adaptation.
Right.
So, and, yeah, there's some reasons we can think of why.
With that model in mind, it's interesting for people to note that different species of animals have very different genetically predetermined sort of maximal lifespans. And I think that that fits into that last factor that you gave there, which is multiple iterations over a given length of time, maybe as opposed to fewer, gives a survival advantage in a more rapidly changing environment.
Mm-hmm. I just read a paper, a story actually in National Geographic, one of the current ones about the longevity of certain animal species. And yeah, those that have the most marked longevity, there's some versions of Icelandic sharks that live like 500 years. It surprised me, but these are environments that don't really offer a lot of radical change. You know, certain tortoises, certain large whales, they're rather stable environments. So yeah, you're saying something that aligns with that. We think that the more need there is for adaptation, the ideally, in terms of the species advantage, not the individual's advantage, but the species advantage, you could iterate a little more quickly.
Okay, and so hormones tie into the story again in the sense that this is essentially a function of aging that seems to be largely biologically predetermined. We are, in a sense, supposed to have declining levels of hormones beyond certain ages. Is that accurate to say, or how would you phrase it differently?
It is. It is. And there's two big facets to that. There's just the crude level of hormones. And then there's this big, rich world of hormone metabolism about how we circulate, how we convert, how we upregulate, you know, how we block. And so the quality of life, there's that certain amount of just hormone crude levels. There's not a lot to do with that. There's certainly cases where you can discuss the idea of replacing what's lacking. But past that point, there's a huge difference in how we can utilize what is there. And that's things that we can do a lot with through lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So with that in mind, you know, some, let's say women are going through premenopause or menopause symptoms at, let's say, their late 30s. Maybe mid-30s, late 30s, and other women are going through it in their late 40s and early 50s. And some women have very severe symptoms as they're going through that, debilitating symptoms, or certainly, you know, greatly affecting their functionality and in life. And other women experience relatively mild symptoms. And do you think those dimensions of that experience, what age you experience it, how severe of symptoms, do you think that those are largely influenced by lifestyle factors or are genetically predetermined, or how do you see that?
There's certainly always some combination of lifestyle and genetics. You know, there's not much else besides that. And the question comes up as to, is there an opportunity? And yeah, we've got good data saying that even if you look at the same hormone levels, there's still going to be a big spectrum of experience. What you described as far as when this happens, how severe it's experienced, that's not consistent even at the same amount of hormones in the system. But there's a big range in how they're utilized, you know, how the body breaks them down, how they're absorbed, how they're excreted. And yes, those are things that lifestyle and specifically diet and specifically choices of plant categories can have a lot to do to modulate.
Okay, so let's talk about, before we get into the specific foods, let's talk about some of the symptoms. So what are the key symptoms that, and you could, I guess, differentiate it by sex if that's warranted. What are some of the key symptoms that would indicate hormonally driven issues in middle-aged humans?
Yeah, and a good point is to have someone think about that they've come on over a certain time frame. So a lot of us have our weak links, things have always been there. So those things can worsen or be affected, but it's more so things that are emergent around those time frames. And you really nailed them, like especially sometimes starting in the later 30s, but more commonly mid-40s, later 40s. And the top five independent of sex would really be weight struggles, energy issues, cognitive function, hot flashes, bigger thing for both genders than I was even aware of until I read some of the studies.
And really, then also for men too, hot flashes.
Yeah, big subset. Oh, I didn't know that. Sometimes a third to 50% of the populations have significant ones.
Interesting. I've been sweating my ass off here in Costa Rica. Maybe that has something to do with it. Or it could just be that I'm in a tropical environment. I feel hotter than normal lately, though. Okay, so...
Come on up here to the frozen tundra and that'll change.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll change pretty fast. I have no doubt that if I was next to you in frozen Minnesota right now, that would have a very different amount of sweat pouring out of my body each day. Okay, so let's tie this into nutrition. So you've written a wonderful cookbook. There's lots of great tips in here. This is really, you know, and it's not just recipes. It's actually educating on the science of how some of these foods actually work to affect some of these five symptoms that you just mentioned. But actually, maybe I'll save the phytochemical thing for later because I think we might get a little bogged down. I know we maybe have some differences of opinion on that one. So let's go into some other mechanisms around this. So one cool mechanism I think for people to know is nitric oxide. And you wrote quite a bit about that and how nitric oxide is utilized in the body. You know what's interesting? You probably know this of all people. You're one of my friends who seems to know the most fun, trivial facts and histories of things. But back in the 1980s, nitric oxide was really seen just as a toxic waste gas, like it was associated with air pollution. And then it eventually was the case that researchers discovered it has all these important roles in human physiology. It eventually went on to win a Nobel Prize for their discovery around the importance of nitric oxide in human physiology. And I think even circa 2023, we're still learning a lot about this story. Many new layers of this story are unfolding. For example, the role of the oral microbiome in producing nitric oxide that goes systemic, and all these, how it ties into stem cells and all kinds of cool stuff. But you wrote quite a bit about this in your book and certain foods that affect it and what pathways and symptoms it affects. So tell us about the nitric oxide story.
That's a cool one. And it's kind of an odd thing. I won't go too far into this, but yeah, you mentioned that there's also the whole nitrate, you know, and sodium nitrate. And, you know, is this a carcinogen? Is it an ergogenic? There's some complicated stuff there. And it's a fascinating story where foods and food matrices work different than the constituents might predict. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but
so the answer of that is this. Tell us about that, because that was a really interesting part of your book. So differentiating the nitrates in, for example, leafy greens and beets versus the nitrates in processed meats. So there's some you talked about in your book, kind of different health outcomes that we have in the research that are associated with those two different sources of nitrates.
Yeah, and it's curious. There's some things that engender a stress response and engender free radical damage in ways that, in the case of smoked and processed meats, it seems that their correlations with stomach and esophageal cancer correlates with their nitrate content. Mm-hmm. But yet we can also see nitrates engendering a different response in the context of whole foods, in the context of polyphenols in whole foods. So the same things, given their context, you know, given their food matrix, a common phrase now, they'll work completely differently. You know, one is a clear thing for cancer risk and one is a clear thing benefiting aerobic performance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, super, super interesting. Okay, so what about, how does nitric oxide and that story, nitrates and nitric oxide, tie into the five hormonally driven symptoms that you mentioned?
Well, we've got massive data sets on endurance athletes and the effects that nitrate enhancing compounds have on them. And there's also some good data sets on those who are struggling with fatigue. And I argue there that these populations, their goals are often different, but the mechanisms are the same. Mm-hmm. You know, someone who wants to just, you know, be able to get off the couch and function and get past debilitating fatigue, they want to generate energy more effectively. You know, and that's really the same thing that someone who's trying to run a long event or do whatever else is. It's the same process. They're different expressions. So we've seen, for example, that aerobic capacity can be modulated, improved by 24% over the course of short time frames with high BEAT intake. Mm-hmm. And that's like on par with blood doping. I mean, it's a really big deal.
Yeah, I've actually personally been experimenting a lot lately with nitric oxide boosting strategies in a number of different ways, beets being one of them, other nitrate rich foods, arginine and citrulline and some other stuff. And I have to say, I have a noticeable, very noticeable improvement in my endurance and stamina while surfing and playing tennis. It's not subtle. It's one of the most noticeable things that I've ever done as far as like really seeing a clear performance enhancement from it. So I'm a believer, and I recently found out based on my gene analysis, I had the owner of the DNA company, Kashif Khan, on my podcast, and he did a very like personalized deep dive into my personal genetics. And one of the things he said is that my gene variants related to nitric oxide production are among the worst possible. So that kind of matches up. Because if I do genetically, if I'm performing nitric oxide production very poorly, then that might be somewhat of a limiting factor for me. And when I do endurance exercise, and then it might become more noticeable for someone like me, especially who maybe has a deficit in that, to use some of these nitric oxide supporting supplements and foods.
Yeah, that all fits. And you mentioned the oral microbiome. There's some evidence arguing that we've got actually like chew the stuff or taste it to have it be particularly effective. It's got to mix with saliva perhaps. Yeah.
Actually that's an area that I've spent the last few months doing a deep dive in. I actually think there's a lot more to the saliva story than we have, than people commonly realize and commonly talk about. Even, you know, even among dentists, I think that most are not totally aware of this, but I think that there's a lot of stuff that is very intentionally getting transported from our blood into our saliva, and nitrates being one of those things, and nitrites being one of those things. And there's a lot to this story of the oral microbiome and nitric oxide production. And there's research that you probably saw where they've shown that a lot of the sterilizing compounds that are used in dental mouthwashes that are antimicrobial affect systemic blood pressure. Because when you kill microbes in the mouth that are nitric oxide producing microbes, all of a sudden blood pressure goes up throughout your whole body. And so you know, we're discovering all these interesting links between the foods you eat, blood transporting it, pumping into the saliva, and then those nutrients when they're in the saliva being transformed by microbes that then do other things that produce molecules that have systemic effects on our whole body. And then something as simple as using the commonly prescribed, you know, by your dentist, mouth oral hygiene products are now all of a sudden affecting your oral microbiome, and maybe even something like erectile dysfunction, for example, which is also heavily nitric oxide dependent. So, sure. You know, there's all these interesting links there. So, one of the other things that you talked about in your book that was very interesting was you talked about some interesting things around nuts and almonds and walnuts in particular. Can you talk about that?
You know, pretty cool stuff. So walnuts have some unique compounds called walnut oligopeptides, and it seems that they have some roles to play in helping us clear waste in the body. You know, you're aware of this, most are not, but we don't really know why we get tired. There's not a clear consensus on what makes us slow down or not function as well. But we know there's some correlation with the buildup of various types of waste. There's some element of a factor. They're not directly linear, but we know that these walnut oligopeptides help us clear most waste that have been tracked. So lactate dehydrogenase, blood urea nitrogen, lactic acid, These are all things that these compounds help us eliminate more effectively. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned almonds. There's ways in which we know that foods will work that make them more than just the sum of their parts. I talk about the phytonutrients, but we think about like the macro and the micronutrients. And in many cases, it's tempting to think about foods as being just sources of these macro or micronutrients. But one of the studies that I mentioned about energy output showed that you could take cyclists and give them these cookies, which were the same macronutrients and the same caloric load, or you could give them almonds, things that contain almonds for that same blend. And there was this marked change in output of capacity to exhaustion with the same caloric load and the same macronutrient load. Mm-hmm. So we know that these accessory nutrients are more than the sum of their parts. Mm-hmm.
There was an interesting subsection in your book on low carb fatigue. Talk to me about that.
You know, simple thing, it's just an energy source. The body's got more sources of energy, and the more that are available, the better we can function and perform. A lot of our energy output, of course, is burning these various substrates, you know, carbs and fats being preferential. But the main way we burn fat is beta oxidation. And that works most effectively when there's some supply of glycogen there available. So yeah, so stored carbohydrate as glycogen is directly a fuel source, but it's also a catalyst for the beta oxidation process. Mm-hmm. And we've got multiple papers showing that those who are very low on one of their main macronutrients, in the case of carbs, are more run down for a lot of reasons. Mm-hmm. And mechanistically, it's curious, but there are some ways in which the body correlates overall fuel status with carbohydrate status. And it's not the only fuel. But in the case of insulin, for example, if insulin levels are too low, the body can respond as if there's a marked caloric deficit and centrally inhibit thyroid hormone excretion and also lower thyroid hormone activation. Even if there's not really a fuel deficit, you can get plenty of fuel from other sources. But in some ways, just one of those macros being markedly absent causes the body to go into a famine type mode. Mm-hmm.
Do you see any role for low carb or keto diets, even done temporarily or cyclically, to have benefits, or do you see them mostly as a potential problem?
You know, I'm certainly, if you show me good data, I'll believe anything at all. And I've seen quite a bit of data about the ketogenic diets being useful in medication refractive epilepsy as far as clinical outcomes. And there's countless ways that one can speculate about big outcomes or big benefits about ketone bodies. And, you know, if we have good clinical outcomes, I'm happy to align with that. But people need to know that there are drawbacks. Like in the case of, we've got most of our data sets about larger outcomes from some of these epileptic populations. So we know that kids don't really get thyroid disease. Like the rates of that amongst adolescents, kids is like one out of every 1,200. Mm-hmm. But on ketogenic diets, the rate of marked hypothyroidism that requires medication is about like 27%. Wow. So it's quite common. There's actually a recent now study done on adults on Atkins diets showing the same kind of a process that many saw thyroid dysfunction. And the largest data sets actually come from looking at Ramadan. There's 44 studies to date now looking at the effect of Ramadan on those with existing thyroid disease and also those with normal thyroid function. And this is not fasting, not marked ketogenesis, but, you know, intermittent fasting of sorts. And same sort of thing. We see that when food intake is decreased a lot, or if the timing is changed radically, the body can respond in ways to try to lower its metabolism, try to protect itself against that.
And the distinction there would be that this is some sort of functional, like transient functional decrease in thyroid hormone output, as opposed to like overt Hashimoto's hypothyroidism, like an autoimmune driven hypothyroidism, or is there not a distinction like I'm implying there?
Most data is showing more so the former, but there is some data showing onset of the latter. And okay. So it's kind of commonly thought that if someone has some proclivity towards autoimmune disease, the more their thyroid has to be yelled at to work, the more likely that is to come on. Mm. The thyroid generates massive amounts of free radicals. And so the more stimulation requires for the thyroid to be activated, the more the storm and the more chance there is for dysfunction to set in place. And in some versions that could be lasting.
Got it. Okay. One of the other... before we go on, within the subject of energy, since this is the energy blueprint, it might be worth emphasizing this one above all else. Are there any other foods and supplements you think are worth mentioning in this category for improving energy levels
You know, one fun one to mention that's had some good data too is oats. And we know that beta-glucan may be part of the story, but there are ways in which they specifically can benefit Krebs cycle metabolism. And this also seems to be rather independent of just their content of calories or macronutrients. One trial that I mentioned in the book took some that had impaired quality of life scores due to chronic fatigue. And the intervention was just a couple ounces of dietary oat per day. And they did track the beta-glucan content, but the beta-glucan content was not different from what it is any commercial oat products. And the amount of oats consumed was rather common. Mm-hmm. And they saw about a 40% improvement in quality of life scores over the course of a few months. So yeah, oats are a really fun food. Very, very underutilized, I think.
Yes. Yeah, agreed. And not only underutilized, but also heavily demonized in some circles now. Just yeah. Being part of the grain family.
One of my favorite recipes was the savory steel cut oat pilaf. Mm-hmm. So yeah, oats can be savory dishes as well. They're really good.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about brain fog. So what are some of the key mechanisms or key foods and supplements that are especially beneficial for improving cognitive function?
Yeah, lots of good data around many. The couple that I really highlighted here would be basil, rosemary. I mentioned trout a fair amount too. I'll come back to that. But we think about how quickly symptoms can change. And symptoms differ in whether they're more symptoms of how something is working or of how something is structured. So like an extreme example could be bone density. You know, it takes time to repair bones. You know, even if you do the right stuff today, you won't have better bones tomorrow. You know, it takes time for that to play out. But some things can work quite quickly in the body. And there's many ways in which symptoms can change almost instantaneously. And in the case of rosemary as a nootropic, there've been several papers showing that at the quickest amount of ingestion, whether it's smelling it or tasting it, there can be clear improvements in cognitive function.
Yeah. Okay. So talk to me about trout as well. What's going on there and why trout as opposed to salmon?
Sure. There's so many great seafood options. Tricky thing that I try to balance with that is think a lot about sustainability, think a lot about contaminants. And then in my world, I think a lot about iodine as well. You know, there's many that are struggling with thyroid disease, and there's some window of being on the lower amount of iodine intake that not only can stabilize things, but can reverse things for the majority of adults. We've got many papers showing that now. And so a trick is, how do you achieve that without cutting out some really important food categories? And seafood's a tricky one, but trout is an awesome food because it's rather readily available, you know, cost-effective, and rich in all the relevant micronutrients and also essential fats that we see in seafood. But also it's checking all those boxes, you know, not high in iodine, no big sustainability issues, also not a big problem with other common contaminants like PCBs. So yeah, real winner.
You said something there in passing that might, I know it's sort of a matter of routine for you, and I've had many discussions with you about this, so I know kind of the broader story around this, but I want to make sure listeners are aware of what you said, because there's still so much information out there that exists that is really saying the exact opposite of what you just said, in the sense of people advising to improve their thyroid health by consuming more iodine, saying, hey, iodine is this really important nutrient for your thyroid gland to produce thyroid hormones. So you got to make sure to take in iodine via supplementing with iodine, via consuming more seaweed, via, you know, those kinds of things. It's also the case that most thyroid supporting supplements on the market are making a point of including iodine. Mm-hmm. And I just want to draw this distinction there between that and what you're saying, which is, hey, avoid excessive iodine intake. Not only don't supplement with iodine, but actually try to minimize your iodine intake. So just explain the broader story there for people so they can understand how to make sense of your view versus the maybe more common view out there.
Sure. Yeah. So quick version of this, the iodine is not a bad guy. We do need it, but we need it in a certain window. And your listeners are used to things in more nuance and more depth and more thoughtfulness. So nutrients are never good or bad. And it's not that there's a linear relationship between a nutrient intake and the function of a body. my favorite analogy is like keys for the car. You know, if your keys are missing, your cars won't move. And when you get that key back again, magically your car works. And nutrients are like that. But if your car's running, 1,000 keys won't make your car go faster. So that's how it works in this case. Now,
Alan, everybody knows more is always better.
Well, in the case of nutrients, we always know that there's a point where you're deficient and a point where you're toxic. That's always the case. And in most cases, that's a really broad spectrum. It's rather wide. But there's also a level of intolerance. And there's ways in which exposure may not be overtly toxic, but it may be harmful for a subset of the population. We talked early on about how hormones, I get this visual in my mind about like playing pinball, where you got the ball moving around and you're working hard to keep it in play. You're moving it, it's falling through this hole, you're moving it there. That's how things circulate in the body. You know, nutrients, hormones, there's a lot of ways they're peripherally managed and metabolized. In the case of iodine, that's a set of enzymes called D-iodinase. A lot of people have variations in those enzymes. So our understanding is that early humans were really in two main types of environments as far as iodine was concerned. A lot of people were in coastal areas and they ate a lot of shellfish, probably a lot of dietary seaweed, tons of seafood. So they have a set of enzymes that allows them to get rid of too much iodine very effectively. That's cool. Another big group of people was more inland. So the trade-off they had to make mechanistically was they had to be better at preserving iodine. So in doing so, they gave up the capacity of getting rid of massive amounts. So either you can skimp on it and you can do well when there's not much, or you can clear a lot, but you can't have both. Mm-hmm. So what we see is that about 20 to 30% of the US population at present is exposed to amounts that we know are excessive for some people. And anyone can get overtly harmed by levels of greater than about 1100 micrograms per day. That's not hard to get, and that's based upon WHO data. We've seen pretty clear manifestations in areas that have fortified with iodine, how it affects the rate of thyroid disease. But some people, if they're above 200 micrograms, they're prone to have thyroid disease come on. And we see this pretty repeatedly. Like in the case of the US, we fortified with iodine starting in 1924. It was voluntary. It was just done in Michigan. Before then, the rate of autoimmune thyroid disease was a few per 100,000. But in the following decade, the rates of it amongst women in their 30s and 40s went up 52-fold, not percent, but fold. So it went from a rarity to a commonplace issue. And this was written about in the Mayo Clinic journals. Doctors were saying, hey, look, I'm seeing all this thyroid disease now. Why are we doing this? You know, Denmark just fortified in the year 2000. They've tracked the last 15 years. They've seen thyroid disease go up. So there was three pretty pivotal studies looking at, great, we now know that there's this window where it can be a problem, but is there an opportunity? So mm-hmm. studies have now shown that if people get to a low enough range, not only will it stabilize their thyroid function, but it will reverse the disease for a large percent of people. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, iodine is in so many common foods that it's not an easy thing to get deficient in. We've actually had 6 documented cases of iodine deficiency in the US since 1980. So it's not impossible, but it's extremely rare. Mm-hmm. And yeah, most who are prone to those issues easily get too much more so than too little.
Yeah. This is a quick digression, but I can't resist. So there's my wife's sister is married to an Italian guy, and his name is Raffaele. He's a wonderful guy, and we spend a lot of time with him. What's interesting is that my wife's sister, who I'm good friends with, is very attuned to like studying health and studying my work and your work and, you know, many of our friends and colleagues. And so she's kind of, you know, on to the latest stuff when it comes to nutrition and other aspects of health. Her husband's family in Italy, her husband's parents are very sort of entrenched in the mentality of sort of following whatever the mainstream authorities are saying. And so there are certain things like they're deathly afraid of consuming eggs because of the dietary cholesterol. They think, you know, consuming salt is really a big problem. And, you know, many, so they'll consume a bread of, they'll consume a breakfast of like nothing but pastries and sugar. But as long as they feel they're avoiding the evil of dietary cholesterol that's in eggs, they feel like they're doing an amazing job of keeping themselves healthy. anyway, I could, there's many more examples to this, but one of the most interesting things is my wife's sister was telling me recently, she was having a discussion with her husband's parents in Italy about salt. And they're of the opinion that, you know, like, yeah, we have to consume iodized salt. We have to get this because the authorities are telling us that iodized salt is better. We need the extra iodine. And that's what the medical authorities are saying. And therefore, you know, of course, we're going to follow the medical authorities. And so she's over there saying like, hey, no, you should consume just regular sea salt instead of the iodized stuff. And they're like, well, why? Why should I trust you instead of the medical authorities, right? So anyway, that's interesting. And I thought it was particularly interesting to bring up here in this discussion to get your sense of, you know, what's going on there. I mean, there's like a psychological component to that, right? Like the cognitive bias of sort of defaulting to trusting medical authorities versus the contrarian position of defaulting to distrusting medical authorities. But there's also an element here where I think generally you would side towards the maybe the mainstream. And then in this case, this is something that's like an example of more of a contrarian view where your views would differ from the mainstream.
I would argue that everything I've said is reflected by comments from the American Heart Association, the American Academy of Clinical Endocrinology. No one's pushing for iodized salt right now. No one's pushing for iodine supplementation during pregnancy.
Meaning they've changed recently, relatively recently.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, there's not guidelines pushing for that in the modern populations.
Yeah.
Many are arguing that it's equivocal and if anything, possibly even harmful.
Right.
But yeah, there's often a perception of what is thought. And then there's like the reality of current data, current policies. And the further you get down into a lot of medical specialties, the more they are aligned with evidence. But in many cases, existing habits and ideas do not stay current with that.
Yeah. And I think many other countries, like, you know, I'm down here in Costa Rica, and I would say they're probably at least 20 years behind as far as common practices among doctors here. It's at least 20 years behind what's going on in the United States. It's almost like traveling back in time. You know, for example, you travel to certain places where they think margarine is still super healthy, you know, and it's really like going back in time 20 or 30 years ago in the States where everybody was saying, hey, you know, all the medical authorities saying, get rid of butter, margarine is great for you and it's going to prevent heart disease. It's a similar thing like that. All you got to do is just go to a different country and you can experience something like that. So talk to me about menopause. And what are some of the foods that act on some of those pathways in beneficial ways?
You know, one funny thing, you might appreciate this. Do you know how long menopause actually lasts?
I don't know.
24 hours.
Really? Okay, explain that.
So the way it's defined, it's stupid, but menopause is defined as the cessation of natural menstrual cycles for one calendar year. And then postmenopause is defined as a day after menopause. So when you really get down to the details, menopause is a day, which is dumb because that's doesn't fit how we think about things, but that's just a quirk of categorization.
Right.
So yeah, so there's this big transition and the concept is that there's a decline in ovarian output of estradiol and an increase of adrenal output of estrone. And it's pretty often a jagged process for maybe half a dozen years or so, often like mid 40s to early 50s. And then afterward, menstrual cycles stop. And then we'll enter this postmenopausal phase, which most think about that as being several years after menopause. It's often a process of about 5 years of symptoms where the periods stop. And then usually about half a dozen years of marked symptoms after they have stopped. So often about a decade of really experiencing something. And in terms of, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. So yeah, I was just going to say
you're asking about foods.
Of foods. Yeah.
Yeah. So really cool thing. We have this effect by which foods modulate the hormones. And as a generalization, there's different types of estrogen receptors. There's the alpha and beta receptors. And we can think about one as being ones that are generally helpful to have activated, or the good ones, so to speak, and others that can often be overactivated. And we think about like how there can be these xenobiotics or these plastic compounds or synthetic estrogens and the harmful effects of them. Well, what can happen is they can overly stimulate the receptors in breast cells or in the endometrial lining and cause dysplasia or cancerous growth or whatnot. And then we also got these receptors that are found in connective tissues, like the bones or collagen of the skin, or even in brain cells. And these are predominantly the alpha receptors. So as these lose their stimulation, we start seeing more of the classic symptoms, the hot flashes, the night sweats, the thinning skin and hair, the thinning bones. And the paradox, though, is that as there's less activation of those wanted alpha receptors, there's often continual or even more activation of those unwanted beta receptors. So we see a lot of the problems of estrogen emerging when there's less total estrogen in the body. And that's always been a bit of a paradox when we understood these receptors. And so the cool thing is that plants, they contain estrogens, are called phytoestrogens. They're not the same as human estrogens. And what we now know is they act more so on these receptors, and they're called selective estrogen response modifiers. So if we think about these receptors as like the lock and the estrogen as the key, imagine there's one key you don't want open. There's like, that's the Pandora's box. That's the bad stuff that creates the cancerous growth. Well, what these response modifiers do, they're basically like wax that goes inside that keyhole and plugs it up. So not only do they not open it, but they prevent the regular key from opening it. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, on the things you want to have activated, they'll go in and, you know, tidy that up, open that key and lubricate the lock. So now it works even better afterward. So the same phytoestrogens can help some receptors and inhibit others.
So I have a super deep and profound philosophical question for you. It's gonna be simple on the surface, but there's deeper layers to this. So regarding what you just said, what is your sort of paradigm with regards to understanding the relationship of those chemicals in those plants and those actions that you just described, and this being just one of, let's say, at least 100, maybe 500, 1,000 different similar sorts of examples of interactions between phytochemicals and human physiology. But is your paradigm around this, and to be clear, this is not a right or wrong thing. This is just, I'm curious about what your worldview is and this philosophy is in this regard. Is your understanding or your belief that this is sort of a randomness, or that and coincidence that these things act in a certain way? Or do you consider it, you know, maybe a religious person would consider it like God's intention to design things in this way? Obviously, I know your religious beliefs would not indicate that you believe that's true. Or do you see it as a product of millions of years of coevolution? Like, or, you know, is it, I guess it's either going to be random coincidence or the sort of in product of millions of years of coevolution. But I'm just curious what your take on that is.
You know, if it was one particular chemical pathway we were talking about, I think you could make a case for random coincidence, but there's just so many of them. You know, I think it's hard to argue against the idea that we've co-evolved and that our normal physiologic functions are not, it's not that we're, all these things we're talking about and all these recipes and these ideas, these aren't ways to hack the body and make the body work better. This is what the body is used to. This is how the body works normally. And our bodies are thinking that, you know, they could do these various things, but somewhere along the way, they're going to get some plant signal to help them do that better. And they depend upon that. Mm-hmm. And there's probably ways you could make arguments by which the plants are expecting us to help them with their propagation and managing some of their competitors or whatnot. So yeah, I think you can make a strong, I think it'd be hard to argue against the idea of there being coevolutionary adaptation.
Yeah, I agree completely. Actually, there was a really funny thing from Michael Pollan where he was talking about how, you know, sort of reconceptualizing our relationship with grass and saying that, you know, grass is using humans to spread all around the world, that grass has manipulated the human species in a way for its own benefit to have us, you know, as that, like grass as the puppeteer of humans, to forcing us and manipulating us to spread it all over the world. It's been quite successful in that regard. So let's talk about insomnia. And actually, you know what, before we get there, so I want to just Should we go deeper into phytochemicals and insecticides? Actually, here's one layer that would be interesting. The carnivore trend. There's many people out there now who are, and this segues very naturally with what you're just talking about. There's many people out there now promoting an idea of, hey, you know, animals can run away from us. And, you know, so if we're out there trying to hunt animals, these animals have legs and they can physically run away, and that's their mechanism of evasion. But plants, they don't have this capacity to run away from us. So what they evolved instead is these defense chemicals, these toxins, which are designed to poison potential predators, animals, potentially animals that would consume them. To poison them or to make them feel ill or something like that. But basically that these are plant defense chemicals. These are toxins designed for the plant to poison would-be consumers of that plant. And that therefore, by extension of this train of logic, that these compounds and plants are therefore toxic. They're trying to kill us, as some people are saying, and that therefore they're bad for our health, and therefore we should avoid consuming plant foods because they're full of toxins that are trying to kill us. You and I are very much on the same page with how we understand those claims, but I would like to have people hear what your take is on people making those kinds of claims.
I think the first thing I'd like to lead with is not even to directly address it, but to talk about the thought process. You know, the complex world of biochemistry and human nutrition, you can make a story for anything and you can make it sound very plausible. So what you have to ask yourself is, you know, is this a theory? Is this an idea? Or is this really an observation from living things? You know, we are complex systems. We self-regulate. And the only way to know what will happen to us is to observe what happens to us.
Yes.
And if it were true that the net benefit of a higher plant food intake was harmful effects, we would have abundant evidence of that. And we should have many studies looking at people that have higher intakes of plant foods having more severe health outcomes. And we have the exact opposite of that in spades.
Yeah.
So yeah, we have very clear evidence that humans who consume more plants and a broader range of plants are healthier people. And the mechanism they propose, that's a plausible mechanism, but it seems that these toxins in the amounts in which we ingest them in plants and in the context of the food matrices of plants have net benefit. That in some way our bodies observe this possible threat and they then respond to that. Like, for example, we can see glucosinolates in broccoli, and these things are liver toxic, but in the amounts in broccoli and in the context of the plant, in the context of a meal, if anything, they help our liver function improve. You know, our body realizes, hey, I've got to have this pathway work well because there might be more of this coming down the road. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, we become more effective at regulating hormones, clearing out other foreign things. There's net benefit to that for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Very well said. I see the type of logic, the type of thinking as also being analogous, you know, in the spirit of what you just said about a story can be made up for anything based on mechanisms.
Yeah.
One could say, hey, you know, free radicals are really bad for you and they cause all this damage. And look, here's these 1,000 studies showing that free radicals drive this disease and that disease. And guess what? Exercise creates a huge spike in free radicals. And therefore, exercise is really terrible for you. It's toxic. Sure. You should avoid exercise at all costs because it's trying to poison you and kill you. Right. And you can actually make up a very scientific sounding and logical sounding story that is at complete odds with everything we actually know about the effects of exercise on human health and longevity.
Well, and the thing is, there's no debate that we are biologically omnivores. We've got the apparatus of omnivores. And so as such, we can subsist on a huge range of foods. You know, we could eat only meat and not fall over dead tomorrow. That's totally true. We could eat only plants and not fall over dead tomorrow. We've got a large range of things. But we've got good evidence that people that are the healthiest have a lot of diversity in their diets, a lot of food categories. The other point that's hard to square with that idea is just this point about the microbiome. I think that it's pretty hard to deny the fact that it's important to have good bugs in our intestinal tracts. Mm-hmm. And these good bugs feed solely off of plant residues. So to avoid those is just like a daily ingestion of broad spectrum antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. I think we should wrap up maybe just with a quick bit on sleep, one of the other main categories that you mentioned. So there's some interesting tips in here on specific foods that are useful for this. Also, tart cherry is an interesting one. And there's been some interesting exploration of the mechanisms around tart cherry over the years. Some people noticing that it has small amounts of melatonin in there and saying, well, maybe it's the melatonin responsible for these sleep enhancing effects. So what's the deal with tart cherry, and maybe any other foods that you want to mention in this category?
Yeah, there's the mechanism and the outcome. And just I briefly want to mention this more because you've talked about this contrast too. You know, if the mechanisms suggest something is not even possible, you've got to really question the outcome. But a mechanism alone is not evidence. You know, an outcome will be more important than a mechanism. But yeah, the mechanisms have to at least make it possible. if it would defy the law of physics, then you've got to really question the outcome. So yeah, there's some mechanisms by which plants contain melatonin, and actually in rather robust amounts. But the curious thing is we've got clear outcome data showing that their benefits can be disproportionate to their melatonin content. Mm-hmm. So cherries, for example, there's been shown to be some great timed sleep effects, meaning ingestion later in the day having positive effects upon sleep onset and sleep quality. And a really cool thing is that amongst elderly people, we also have data saying that it can decrease dizziness and decrease fall risk most likely. And that's important because those who are struggling with sleep are often, their other consideration is sleep aids. And they're notorious for raising fall risks and impairing cognitive function. You know, super brief stat, Zolpidem, Ambien, one of the biggest sleep aids for quite some time, there's data showing that irregular use of it can increase total non-apnea-rated mortality risk by ninefold amongst people. And irregular use in the study was defined as 18 uses per year. So wow. Sleep aids are horribly dangerous, but there are safe ways that can help a lot. So cherries are one. Two others that I mentioned, black rice, kind of a rich source of more so polyphenols, but still seems to be useful in those ways. And also more of a short acting effect. But then another fun one is pistachios. And they're probably the densest plant concentration for melatonin. But in the case of them and in cherries, the change in the participants' output of melatonin greatly exceeds their ingestion. So when you consume these plants that contain that, not only does it not inhibit what you make, but it augments what you make. You make it better on your own.
Yeah, there's some super interesting layers to that. One interesting thing is on pistachios, I actually saw some research that emerged many years ago, I think maybe the first paper, where researchers came out and said pistachios are really high in melatonin. And then there was some other research that came out, I want to say 2 or 3 years later, that basically put the whole findings of the first paper in question and said, actually, we didn't find very much melatonin at all in these pistachios. And it turns out the first study was funded in, I'm pretty sure I'm getting this right, it was funded in Iran, which is one of the biggest pistachio producers in the world, and maybe it was funded sort of by the pistachio industry as like a marketing ploy to get all this attention. And then the last I heard, there was some discussion over maybe which subspecies of pistachios maybe do or do not have high melatonin content. But the last I heard, there was some sort of, it was all in question. And I actually retracted what I previously had taught about pistachios and melatonin content, because I basically concluded, okay, I'd need more data to figure out what the real story is here as far as their true melatonin content and what subspecies you need to find and all that. But I'm curious if you read anything about that, or maybe you know the latest findings better than I do.
For sure. Yeah, and things can change quickly. But my take on it overall was that there's definitely some uncertainty as to exactly how much you will consume and exactly how certain things will rank. But there's clear data saying that the amount is relevant and that those who do ingest them have improved outputs and improved sleep quality. Mm-hmm. So yes, certainly inconsistencies as far as amounts, varietal subspecies, but the high level picture about this being a useful food is still solid.
Yeah, beautiful. I agree completely. For everybody listening, this is a book, the Hormone Healing Cookbook, which I highly, highly recommend that you go grab. It's full of very useful information, lots of great science that you won't find elsewhere, and useful tips like what you heard Dr. Christensen give here today. Dr. Christensen, is there any final words you want to leave people with, or any place you want to direct people to?
No, just wherever you get books normally, give your local bookstore some love if you can. There's always Barnes & Noble and Amazon, of course, but you know, stay tuned to what Ari's sharing with you, you know, follow the things you're learning, and know that you've got incredible power over your health, and that affects everything. So yeah, onward and upward.
Awesome. And when is this book coming out, by the way?
June 18th.
June 18th. Okay. So I will release this episode right around there, maybe like within a few days of that on either side of that, just so that it's timely and I'm not releasing this well in advance of when people can actually get it, because I know people want that immediate gratification of having this in their hands and learning the information. Again, everybody listening, highly recommend going out and grabbing this book. I have no financial incentive here to direct you to this. This is just a wonderful book from a great friend of mine who's one of the smartest people that I know in when it comes to natural health. And there's truly a lot of information here that you will get value from. And as I said at the beginning of this, even I learned 3 or 4 or 5 new things that I had never seen before. So go grab it. Hormone Healing Cookbook. Dr. Christensen, thank you so much for coming back on the show for the millionth time. I look forward to podcast number 1,000,001 with you. It's always a pleasure chatting with you, my friend.
Likewise. Great to see you, Ari.
Hey there, this is Ari again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, if you found it valuable, please share it with your friends, share it with your family. Help me get the word out there. Also, if you're on YouTube, make sure to hit the subscribe button and hit that little bell to get notifications every time we release a new video or new episode of the podcast. And if you're listening to this, make sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much for supporting my work at the Energy Blueprint. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I will see you in the next.